Thanks to a book published 150 years ago, we have a concept, survival of the fittest. Competition, evolution, adapt or die, earlier versions falling by the wayside. Charles Darwin was talking about biology, of course, in On the Origin of Species. It was a science book called The Most Important Ever Written. And as NPR's Joe Palca reports, it may be more controversial today than it was when it appeared in 1859.
The notion that species evolved from simpler forms was not a new one in 1859. There had already been several books by then suggesting this radical idea.
The most famous example being a book that came out in Victorian Britain in 1844, an anonymous bestseller. It was called The Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation.
Jim Endersby is a historian of science at the University of Sussex in England. He says Vestiges may have captured the popular imagination, but it was lambasted by scientists for its multiple factual errors and by the clergy for its affront to religious dogma. Endersby says Darwin's book got a much more positive reception.
What really impressed people with Darwin's work was not the idea itself, but the book. It was the fact that there was so much detail, so much evidence.
And it wasn't just scientists who liked the new theory. Popular history holds that the church's condemnation of Darwin was immediate and universal. Endersby says it's not that simple. For example, Endersby says Darwin sent a copy of his book to one of the leading members of the Church of England, the Reverend Charles Kingsley.
And Kingsley writes back to say, you know, it's just as noble a conception of God to think that he created animals and plants that then evolved, that were capable of self-development, as it is to imagine that God has to constantly create new forms and fill in the gaps that he's left in his own creation. And Darwin is very pleased with this quote, and with Kingsley's permission, he has it quoted in the next edition of The Origin.
The relationship between science and religion was changing when the first edition of The Origin appeared in 1859. Jim Secord directs the Darwin Correspondence Project at Cambridge University.
Traditionally, a lot of clerics had actually been leading scientists, and part of the process of developing the idea of science being a separate career or a profession in its own right was in some sense to move away from that, and that's part of where those kind of tensions really arise.
So when scientists start debating Darwin's ideas about evolution, they're keen to take the debate out of the church.
You start seeing people say, well, let's think about this as a scientific question. That's really what it is. Leave the theology, that'll work itself out in some sort of way.
Of course, the theology doesn't always work itself out. Just look at the strong anti-evolution sentiment in certain religions in this country. Secord says The Origin of Species didn't create the rift between science and religion, but it was right there when the rift was opening 150 years ago.
These debates about science and religion, if anything, have actually increased in the last 10, 20 years. And so Darwin is really a big talking point for these kinds of questions. And I think people read Darwin and look to Darwin as a kind of fault line for these kind of continuing controversies.
In the decades following the 1859 publication, support for Darwin's theory grew in all quarters. But historian Jim Endersby believes at least some of that support was based on a misunderstanding of Darwin's ideas. He says there is no predetermined endpoint in the theory of evolution by natural selection, no way progress is supposed to go. But Endersby says some people in England misinterpreted the idea of survival of the fittest to mean some people were meant to survive.
So the English would read the book, and it's no surprise that the English made Darwin a hero in England and buried him in the headquarters of the Church of England, because they read this as saying, look, we the English are top nation, because we're superior. That is why we have the largest empire the world has ever seen. That's why we had the first industrial revolution. That's why we're so rich and powerful. Thank you, Mr. Darwin. You have told us the scientific explanation for what we already know. We're the best.
They still treat Darwin as a hero in England. So maybe now that England's international stature is diminished, the English have come to a more nuanced understanding of his theory. Or not.
The English are best. I wouldn't give talents for all of the rest.
Joe Palca, NPR News.
Bits of these islands of ours, we've left in the hands of three unfriendly powers. Examine the Irishman, Welshman or Scot. You'll find he's a stinker as likely as not.
There's an old expression, seeing is believing. Well, sometimes what you believe can affect what you see. For example, skin color. According to a new study, you will see a biracial political candidate's skin as lighter or darker depending on whether or not you agree with his or her beliefs. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Eugene Caruso is a researcher at the University of Chicago. He recently asked, do people's political beliefs affect how they perceive a candidate's skin tone?
And I guess sort of being a social psychologist, I felt compelled to do at least one study with Barack Obama, given all the interest surrounding his campaign.
He and two colleagues took existing photos of then-candidate Obama and digitally manipulated the parts of the photos that showed exposed skin.
So we sort of isolated the head and the hands of Obama and altered the skin tone to make it relatively lighter in tone or relatively darker in tone.
Then they showed the altered and unaltered photos, one at a time, to about 200 university students.
And essentially we asked them to rate sort of how well each of these photos represents who Obama really is.
The students were also asked about their political beliefs and whether they saw themselves as liberals or conservatives. Here's what the researchers found.
Participants whose partisanship matched that of the candidate they were evaluating, so say liberals evaluating Barack Obama in this case, consistently rated the lightened photographs as more representative of who he really was than the darkened photographs.
People who disagreed with the candidate and held conservative views did the opposite.
That is, they rated the darkened photographs as more representative of who he really was compared to the lightened photographs.
Caruso says they didn't have a lot of non-white students judging the photos in this study, but their patterns tended to be the same.
And because we're basing our prediction on a political party rather than racial identity, we sort of expect the results to hold somewhat independent of the participant's race.
The results are reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Keith Maddox is a psychology researcher at Tufts University who has studied the social meaning of skin tone. He says the findings go with long-held cultural prejudices about things that are light as being positive and things that are dark as being negative.
You know, we think about, you know, the guy wearing the black hat is the bad guy and the guy wearing the white hat is the good guy. You know, there are all these different sorts of cultural associations like, you know, angel food cake and devil food cake. And so that's one of the reasons I find it interesting in that it's this idea that you know, that political affiliation or that association that you might have with somebody who agrees with you can sort of change the way you perceive them in a real kind of a real physical sense.
He says people know their existing beliefs influence how they respond to someone's ideas, but they might be surprised to learn that their beliefs can literally shape the way they see the person.
If the brain can bias the perception of, you know, an opinion, it can bias the perception of something that we think of as more concrete, like the, you know, the apparent physical appearance of somebody.
He says it would be interesting to do a similar experiment with a biracial candidate who's conservative. He says this study suggests it would be the liberals who would darken that candidate. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Bluefin tuna is one of the most valuable fish in the sea. A single bluefin tuna can fetch $100,000 at market before it's cut into sushi. But it's been severely overfished, so it's also one of the most endangered fish in the sea. Over the weekend, the International Commission that regulates fishing voted to reduce the quota for bluefin tuna. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, the new quota still allows too much fishing to assure the tuna's survival.
Every year since its inception decades ago, the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tunas gets together to set fishing limits for the bluefin tuna. And every year, the commission has ignored the advice of its own scientists. It's under heavy pressure from the fishing industry, particularly boats working the waters off Europe, who want to catch far more fish than the scientists say is safe. But this year, for a change, the commission suggested a quota that falls within the range of their scientists' advice. And Jane Lubchenco, who heads the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says this new quota is a significant improvement.
But it does not go far enough. It's insufficient to guarantee the long-term viability of either the fish or the fishery.
Lubchenco, as a biologist, is passionate about bluefin tuna. And Lubchenco also has a responsibility as the nation's chief fishing regulator to protect the species from being fished to commercial extinction.
Bluefin tuna are spectacular creatures, and we have a responsibility to ensure their survival. We also understand that the survival of the fishery depends on having healthy populations of fish.
The latest deal establishes a new lower fishing quota and also puts in place new rules designed to reduce overfishing. Even so, the commission itself figures even if these rules are followed, there's only a 60% chance that the species will recover by the year 2023.
That's not a high probability, but it's much better than the current probability.
The chances of recovery are based on the assumption that fishermen will actually keep to the quotas that have been negotiated. Joseph Powers at Louisiana State University is a science advisor to the Tuna Commission, and he says the new quota looks okay, at least on paper.
If, in fact, that were perfectly implemented, then, yes, you would start to begin the long recovery process.
But the fisheries, particularly around Europe, have a dreadful track record in implementing tuna quotas. Susan Lieberman at the Pew Environment Group says some European nations do a very poor job of enforcing the quotas.
And there's a lot of illegal fishing going on, again, particularly in the Mediterranean.
She says fishermen sometimes catch twice as many fish as they are allowed under the formal quotas. So even though the Tuna Commission has finally paid attention to its scientists on eastern bluefin tuna, Lieberman is still very discouraged.
I would say it's not really so much a turning point as a baby step in the right direction. I don't know if the bluefin tuna has enough time for all the little tiny steps, but it's better than nothing.
Lieberman says the commission probably went as far as it did because conservation groups, including hers, are trying to get bluefin tuna protected as an endangered species under a treaty called CITES. The government of Monaco has made that a formal proposal. Commissioners hope they could forestall that action if they took serious enough steps at this meeting. The U.S. government strongly supports Monaco's efforts to ban bluefin tuna trade, but today NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco was a bit noncommittal about what exactly that means.
Because the meetings have just concluded, we haven't had time to consult within the U.S. government and to decide exactly what our next steps are. We're going to be doing that very soon.
That next crucial meeting for the bluefin tuna is slated for March. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Mission managers at NASA announced how they plan to extricate the Mars rover called Spirit from a predicament. Last April, the rover drove into some soft soil and got stuck. As NPR's Joe Palco reports, even if the plan fails, the rover missions have already been successful beyond anybody's wildest dreams.
It's hard to blame mission scientist Jim Bell of Cornell University for sounding a bit celebratory when he greets callers.
Happy Sol 2082 of our 90-day mission.
Sol is what scientists call a Martian day, slightly longer than an Earth day. Actually, I spoke with him earlier in the week. Today is Sol 2084, nearly 6 Earth years on Mars for what was originally designed to be a 3-month mission. Bell is the scientist in charge of the panoramic cameras, or PanCams. They've been sending back remarkable pictures. Just take a look on our website, npr.org.
We never imagined, of course, that they would be doing this well, but for the PanCams, we passed our 250,000 image mark.
Did you so crazily over-design these that they just, you know, they were built for 90 days, but they could last a decade? Or have you been lucky? Or can you see any signs of wear?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. I mean, you really can't talk about over-designing for something that you've never built before. Sony can tell you exactly how long any of its TVs are going to last because they build millions of them. But with space vehicles, they're one-offs. They're one-shot deals.
Or in this case, two-shot deals, because there are two PanCams working on Mars, one on the rover Opportunity, the other on the rover Spirit. And it's Spirit that's gone and got itself into trouble. Last April, as it was driving south, it broke through a thin layer of crusty soil. What was underneath was extremely fine-grained soil, and Spirit's wheels quickly got stuck.
We haven't found a clear solution to how to get Spirit out of its predicament.
John Callis is the rover project manager. He says the situation is challenging. One wheel on the rover stopped working years ago, now another may be in trouble. And the rover's underbelly, what Callis calls the belly pan, is perilously close to some rocks. And perhaps worst of all, every time they've tried to move the rover, it's sunk a little deeper. Sinking much further would be disastrous.
Because if you put the belly pan of the rover on the ground, that's pretty much game over in terms of trying to get the rover out, because then you would be bearing the weight of the rover on the belly pan and not on the wheels where you need the traction.
So after months of working on the problem, on Monday, the team will send the rover instructions to try backing out the way it came in. Managers sound hopeful, but not optimistic. Cornell's Jim Bell says even if the rescue plan fails, there is still science that Spirit can do. In addition to taking pictures, its robotic arm still works. So Bell says it can do things like
analysis of these salty deposits that the rover's stuck in. I mean, it's a great place to get stuck if you had to be stuck somewhere.
On the other side of Mars, Opportunity is still rolling along. It's on a 12-mile trek across a sandy plain to a crater scientists want to explore. Bell says Opportunity is still making cool discoveries. Just the other day, it came across a large rock.
The hope is that this is a piece of Mars that comes from somewhere else. It was thrown out by a big impact crater and just happens to have landed in our path. And this is kind of a free way to sample more of Mars than we have been sampling where we are.
Possibly one more feather in the rover's already well-decorated cap. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Okay, our next report is going to begin in 10, 9, 8, just a few more seconds. And before we start, our science correspondent, Robert Krulwich, wants to remind you that the only creatures we know of who can count down, 7, 6, 5, are us, people. Or so we thought.
Suppose you're an ant, and you want to show another ant how to get to some food or how to get home. What you do is you squeeze some glands on your body. And those glands produce a chemical odor, and the other ants sniff and know that if they follow the trail of that smell, it'll lead to food or it will lead home. But the thing is, there are places on Earth where this system simply doesn't work. In the Sahara Desert, for example, if you're an ant, the sandy surface is constantly being blown around by the wind, so if you put down a chemical scent...
It would not work in the desert,
says Princeton biologist Jim Gould. Smells just blow away. And yet, even though an ant in the Sahara can't leave a smell trail, none...
It gets back home just fine.
But how? Well, scientists know that ants use celestial clues, the position of the sun, for example, to find the direction home. But how do they know the exact distance back to the nest? Well, Harold Wolff at the University of Ulm in Germany proposed, well, maybe ants count. Not out loud, of course.
They certainly don't do that.
No, but maybe they have little pedometers in their brain. So, when they march across the desert to get food, certain cells in their brains record every step they take, every step until they reach their food. And then, when they're done eating and it's time to turn around and go home, the pedometer in their brain simply reverses and counts them down all the way until they get home. They call this the pedometer theory. Now, to find out if there are actually pedometers inside ants' brains, scientists came up with an ingenious experiment that should let us see, and I mean literally see, those pedometers at work if they exist. So, they led a bunch of ants across a bit of Sahara Desert to some food, and while the ants were eating, the scientists trapped them into three separate groups. Now, for the first group, they took out an adhesive.
They're using super glue.
Yeah, he said super glue. Here are the instructions.
Glue a little pig bristle on to make them twice as tall so their steps take them twice as far.
Meaning they attach stiff pig hairs or pig bristles to each and every leg of each ant, turning this first group of ants into kind of Monty Python sort of critters with ridiculously large steps. By the way, what lucky person gets to put six pig bristles on six legs?
Some Swiss graduate student.
Okay, so that's group number one. For the second group, what do?
You trim their legs.
You what?
Just cut them off at the knees. It's very quick, and you'd be surprised how amenable insects are to having things like this done to them.
Oh, come on. Like, you want to be snipped? The point is, with their legs suddenly smaller, every step the ants take becomes shorter.
They're taking little baby steps, maybe only half as far.
And the third group, you just kind of leave alone?
Yeah, you leave them alone.
Okay, now comes the fun part. When everybody was ready, and it was time for the ants to go home, they were released, and says Professor Gould,
these animals are fooled exactly the way you would expect if they were counting steps.
These stilty ants, they took big steps home and ended up well past the nest. These stumpy ants took little itty-bitty steps home, and they ended up shy of the nest. And the regular ants took regular steps home, and they ended up right at the nest. But they all took the same number of steps. So, can we say that all these ants, they all counted?
Yes.
Wait a second. Before you say yes, have we eliminated all the other possibilities?
As far as I'm concerned, all the other possibilities are off the table.
Professor Gould says it's pretty clear ants don't have maps in their heads, don't memorize markers along the route. In fact, the best evidence that ants do have pedometers is after their walk. The scientists took all three groups of ants and pushed them into the nest where they were going to spend the night. And the next morning, hungry again, all three sets of ants, with their new legs, marched off to have a meal. Now, remember the pedometer formula. The steps you take out should equal the number of steps you take back. So the ants ate, and this time when they turned around to go home...
It's a matter of counting steps. And if you are taking giant steps, well, that's fine. It's now 10 giant steps to the food source and 10 back. And if you're taking baby steps, maybe it's 40 to the food source and 40 back. But the point is that because you're counting the steps, you know exactly how far to come back.
So all three sets of ants got home perfectly. And the only explanation, really, is that their pedometers adjusted to their new leg sizes. Or, in a pedometer-like way, ants do count.
That's right.
Another report from The Mind and the Explorations of NPR's Robert Krulwich. And Robert, I understand we can see this experiment close up in full color.
Yep, we have recreated it, the whole thing, in cartoon form, but we should warn you, for the fun of it, we've made it a very scary cartoon.
Impossible? We thought so.
A very scary cartoon.
Unimaginable? We thought that, too.
We call it...
Pedometers in their brains!
Yeah! And you can see it all, the marching ants, the stilts, everything. Just go to npr.org.
Ain't coming back no more. 5, 6,